to go ahead and give a plug that I'm not getting paid to give, but I'll take your 20 later. I would like to ask you, each of you here today, to take personal responsibility to get at least 5 people here for the Josh and Sean McDowell event. And I'm going to tell you why. I was speaking with them in Alberta in April. We were the featured speakers at the Beyond Belief conference. So it was pro-life and pornography. What a conference. You thought this one was bad. But I sat through that entire presentation, and I also watched Josh's presentation to pastors. Jaw-dropping does not even come close to describing what you're about to hear. And I would just, I'm going to go a step further than Dick went and say, would you consider making sure you get 5 people here minimum on your own? Because it's that important. So with that said, I'm surprised to see all of you after last night.
No 20 bucks either.
No 20 bucks. They're not getting 20, but I am. No, okay, all right. We're going to have to enhance my honorarium here. No. Good to see everybody. Let me just very quickly bring last night back into focus. I hope you went and found where the notes are and got them. If you showed up after getting the notes, your salvation is secure. Nothing to worry about. It's only if you got the notes and didn't show up today that you're in trouble. We talked last night primarily about the new dignity. The new dignity is not that humans have value simply because they're humans bearing the image of God. The new dignity, according to the secular culture, is the freedom to reinvent myself any way I want. And one of you came up to me this morning and said, you went home last night, flipped on the news, and they were having a debate about the guy who's 69 who wants to be 49. And the panelists on the news, half of them thought, why not? This is what we're dealing with. I was not kidding you last night when I said the new idea of human dignity is an unfettered will to power to reinvent myself however I want with no natural limits. And we are going to see that today on the topics of assisted suicide and genetic enhancements in biotech. We'll see that same new dignity theme running through those topics as we did last night. Last night when we talked about assisted reproductive technologies, those technologies that are used to help couples conceive that are struggling with infertility, we mentioned that we weren't arguing that all assisted technologies are wrong, but they must fall within biblical fence posts. And one of the big ones was that couples who use assisted technologies will always take personal responsibility for every embryo that's created. They're not going to do an assisted technology that leaves them with 20 embryos on ice that they'll never be able to implant and bring to birth. And that means it's going to be expensive. It's not going to be easy. So as Christians, we want to evaluate these technologies within a biblical framework and not just go with the scientism worldview that says, if we can do it, we ought to do it. That was the essence of what we went over last night. Today, we're going to the other end of the spectrum first, and then we'll come back to talk about enhancements. Last night, I asked you, how many of you have ever walked a loved one through the final stages of life? Can I see your hands again? You've done that. Okay, most of us in this room. I've done this. My sister died 2 years ago at age 46. She was a chronic alcohol and drug abuser, had been estranged from her own kids for 16 years. Had to live with my parents who lived next door to us, and we had to kind of oversee her. She was a disaster. And by the way, anybody who tells me that marijuana is no big deal, I'd like them to walk what we walk through. It is a gateway drug, folks. It is not an easy thing and no big deal. Yeah, it is. And that's what got her going, and it ruined her life. Now, there's a redemptive side to it, which I hope to get to later in this session. But I've walked this road. Now, I want you to think for a moment, like we did last night, that you just received an email from someone in your church. It is from a grief-stricken wife whose husband is in the final stages of cancer. And he has now indicated that he wants no further treatment. And yet friends of his are saying that if he's truly pro-life, he's got to fight this to the end. He doesn't want any more treatment. He's content to die. He also is at a point, according to his physician, where if we do not ratchet up the level of morphine, we're not going to be able to control his pain. And the doctor has said, listen, here's what's going to happen with this. If we don't ratchet up the morphine as he nears the end, his suffering is going to be awful. But there's always the risk, not only that he will not be as consciously aware of his surroundings, there's also the risk that ratcheting up the morphine may unintentionally hasten death. We're not aiming at it, but it could happen. And this grief-stricken wife has written you an email as a leader in your church saying, what do I do? Should I continue with every form of treatment imaginable until the end, override his wishes if I'm able, try to convince him to go forward, or is it okay to stop? And what about the morphine? Is it okay to use it to control his pain given what he's going through? And she's written you and wants to know what the Christian response to this is. She and her husband are pro-life. They believe abortion, doctor-assisted suicide, are wrong. And let's define our terms real quick here. Doctor-assisted suicide is where the physician gives you, the patient, a lethal dose that you take on your own. Euthanasia is where he kills you directly with a lethal injection. This couple is not in favor of either of those. They reject them. But they want to know, what's the pro-life, what's the Christian thing to do? What are you going to tell them? What are you going to tell them? Any ideas? What are you going to do about withholding the treatment?
Well, I'd like for them to define life if they're Christians, because Jesus said that who you believe in me shall never die. So life is an eternal thing.
Okay.
And so there is a hope for this person, that the real person doesn't die.
So for the Christian, death is not the horrible thing it is for the unbeliever. It can be the gateway to eternity. Okay, who else? What are you going to tell this couple, though, about the two specific questions about withholding treatment and morphine? Yes, ma'am.
I worked for hospice in the past.
Yep.
We decided to do the nursing care, and I gave her enough morphine to keep her comfortable, and she was right in the ward. She was ready to go in her late 80s, and I had, you know, it's a matter of controlling the pain and having an eternal perspective, and are they right with the Lord? Are they ready to go? Why not take care of the pain? Mm-hmm. Make them comfortable. Find that happy medium between staying conscious enough to know where you're at, but dealing with the severe pain so that they can pass in relative comfort.
Okay. All right. Very good. One more. Yes.
I had some hesitation when my mother passed away because the nurse came in and actually gave her a couple syringes of morphine to speed it along.
Okay.
And I really struggled with it.
Yes. Oh.
Okay, so on one hand here, we have an aim at controlling pain. In this situation, the aim was not controlling pain, but something else, speeding it along. Mm-hmm. Very important distinction we're going to come back to in just a moment. By the way, I understand this because with my sister, there was one of the physicians working with her that total utilitarian mindset. It's like, hey man, let's just start making some decisions here. Wait a minute. And you also have to be careful about how individual hospitals define hospice care. There's a lot of things to consider here, absolutely. So I'm not surprised that that happened. One more over here. Yes.
I love this question, and having been in healthcare, it's really provocative for me. But I think what we have to also be very, very careful of is our own desire to not lose that person at the expense of their pain and stalling it out because the body is just a corpse, you know, like we're worth $6.36, I think, by mineral content. And but it, you know, it's our body. But as a Christian, we do know that it is the past, you know, it's a passage to our future and eternity. So I think that while medicine, you know, God gave us medicine just as much as he gave us the Bible. He's the God, author of all Scientology and, I mean, everything. You know, he's the creator.
I'm not sure Scientology. I would agree, science.
Science.
That's all right.
Right, yeah. But I think we do have to be very careful that we are not protecting ourselves from the loss to the point where we aren't relieving their suffering, because death is a given at some point for every one of us. So there's no reason to stall it out just because we are afraid to lose them. And when they're unable to live, and they're just suffering, you know. So I do believe that we can use all of the medicine appropriate, but at a time.
Sure.
Enough's enough.
I think you'll be happy to know that though there isn't a verse in Scripture or a passage in Scripture that spells out exactly what you do on issues like this, there are biblical principles we can rely on that are rational, that make sense, and protect human dignity. We're not left to just punt to relativism where we say, well, whatever the person wants. So let's start with, I'm going to give you 6 questions to help you think clearly about doctor-assisted suicide. And these 6 questions, I think, will put us on the path toward thinking biblically. And the first question is, what's our case? Yes?
Scott, remind them about the notes so they don't have to.
Oh, yeah. If you are wondering, did I provide notes for this session? Yes, I did. If you go to the Big Sky Worldview form and go to the tab at the top that says articles, and I think it's archives articles.
Resources?
Library. Okay, so resources library on the Big Sky Worldview form. You can find 17 pages. You can find the notes. And everything I'm talking about is in those notes. To quote Arnold, trust me, they're there, okay? You'll find them. Principle number 1 in Scripture is that we are to set forth our case. In fact, I was pleased to hear what I just heard at the introduction here in the prayer, that we are to be ready to give an answer for the hope that lies within us, 1 Peter 3:15. So what is our case? One of the things you will learn as you do apologetics, if you can start with a syllogism, you'll be in the driver's seat. You're thinking, what is a syllogism? It's too early for that. Caffeine is not kicked in yet. You use syllogisms all the time. If you've had teenagers in the home, you used them on your teenagers all the time. Dad and mom, can I have the keys? I'd like to drive. No, son, we had an agreement that your driving was predicated upon having good grades. You do not have good grades. In fact, your GPA is at F+, therefore you will not drive. That is a syllogism. Socrates is a man, all men are mortal, therefore Socrates is mortal. That is a syllogism. Now, why are syllogisms important? Because it does 2 things. It clarifies exactly what you're arguing and protects you from people changing the subject. Have you ever been in a debate or argument with your spouse and they just change the subject on you when you were clearly winning the argument? Anybody want to admit that? Now, how many of you do that when you're losing? Yeah, okay, yeah. Isn't that funny? People do this on this topic. You bring up your reasons for being against doctor-assisted suicide, and here's the comment. You just hate people who are dying. You don't care about their autonomy. You don't care about relieving their pain. None of that is what's at issue here. We can fix all that. So we want a clear argument that keeps us tethered to a place we're going to keep going back to when they try to change their subject. So here is our syllogism on doctor-assisted suicide. This will sound familiar to those of you that were here last night. Premise 1, it is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. It is wrong to intentionally kill an innocent human being. Premise 2, doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia intentionally kill innocent human beings. Therefore, what's the conclusion? They are wrong. It is wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia do that. Therefore, they are wrong. That's our case. Now, this is what is important for you to know. It sends two messages to people when you spell out your case that clearly. And this is in your notes. Number one, it sends the message that you're not talking about preferences, you're talking about what's true regardless of preferences. Because when our culture hears a moral claim like it's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings, doctor-assisted suicide does that, therefore it's wrong. You know what goes on in their mind? It gets switched immediately. Oh, you just don't like assisted suicide. Well, maybe I do and maybe I don't. How is that even relevant? I would love to steal my father-in-law's Corvette. He's 85. He drives new Corvettes. He's got two Harleys, rides horses, and he skis. He is not going to die in his sleep. He will die at age 99, flying off a cliff, skiing right into the arms of Jesus. That's how he's going to go. All right? I know where the keys to that new vet are, assuming that fire out in Malibu has not destroyed his home. He's right on the evacuation border. I'm not going to do it, though, because though I'd like to do it, it would be what? Wrong. The problem is our culture, they hear us make moral claims, they think we're just talking about likes and dislikes, like the popular bumper sticker, don't like abortion, don't have one. Well, how about this one? Don't like spousal abuse, don't beat your spouse. Don't like slavery, don't own one. You see the problem with this? We have to make our case clear so people don't change the kind of claim we're making. But there's a second reason we want to do this. When they change the topic, we want to take them back to what we actually argued, not the distraction they're throwing at us. And your syllogism will do that. So what is our case? It's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Doctor-assisted suicide does that. Therefore, it's wrong. That's what's going on. Second question, and this one is big, really big. What is the debate about doctor-assisted suicide really about? Here's what you're going to hear on the news. Autonomy, individual freedom, pain relief, utility. It's actually about none of those things. Here's what the debate is really about. Remember last night I told you worldview is everything? Let's get at the worldview behind this. Let's not just look at the act. Let's get to the worldview. What is the worldview that's out there on physician-assisted suicide that we need to be mindful of? Here it is. Some lives are not worth living. And I'm going to prove it to you. Go to Bozeman, go to Montana State University, walk on campus, set up a discussion table, put up a sign, and say and ask simply one question. Who gets suicide prevention and who gets suicide assistance? And then engage people. Say something like this. Should an 85-year-old man who is depressed get suicide assistance or suicide prevention? What's the answer going to be on that college campus 90% of the time? His choice. If he wants suicide assistance, we should give it to him. Okay? How about an 18-year-old college freshman who is depressed? Should they get suicide prevention or suicide assistance? What's the answer going to be? Prevention. They got their whole lives in front of them. Stop right there. Do you see what just happened? Your critic made a value judgment that the 85-year-old's life wasn't worth living, so we'll give him assistance in suicide, but we won't give it to the 18-year-old. That's a failure to treat human beings equally. In a culture that touts equality as the number one thing. By the way, heads up, the secular culture cannot hold a candle to the Christian worldview on the question of equality. We actually have a basis for it. They don't. So you will fundamentally see they don't treat people equally. Let me give you another example. You go to the university, you ask the student this question. Should a 35-year-old man who is struggling with depression, and he is in a wheelchair, be offered suicide assistance or suicide prevention? What's the answer going to be?
Assistance.
35. Probably prevention. Take that same guy in a wheelchair at 80, and what's the answer going to be? Yeah. Or how about this one? A perfectly healthy 35-year-old who wants to die. Suicide assistance or suicide prevention? What will the students say?
Prevention.
How about this? That same 35-year-old as a paraplegic. Suicide prevention or suicide assistance? What will the students say?
Assistance
if he wants it. Once again, we're making a decision that some lives are not worth living. Is everybody catching this? Because if you forget everything else I'm going to talk about in this session, I want you to get this point. This debate is not about freedom, autonomy, individual rights. It's about us making a value judgment about whose life counts and whose doesn't. That is a major worldview, philosophical premise that is driving this debate. And by the way, it's not new. This started in our country well over 100 years ago. In 1915, Dr. Harry Hazelden at the Chicago Children's Hospital witnessed the birth of a baby boy with defects. And he instructed his team not to treat the child. Let it die. And we're thinking, whoa, 1915 this happened? Yeah. Listen to his rhetoric, or his rationale. When the nurse confronted him and said, we should do something to save this child, Hazelden said, I'm afraid he might live if we do. In other words, what bothered Hazelden is this child might live a life not worthy of life. That's the philosophical premise in play here. And by the way, the American eugenics scene was massive prior to World War II. You do know that many American intellectuals, prior to the knowledge of the death camps getting out, thought Hitler was doing something pretty cool over there with his eugenic stuff. We were fascinated with it here. You think it's bad now, it was way worse back then. Read some of the literature from that time. But after World War II, what happened is there was a shift in the way that euthanasia advocates approached their topic. They realized eugenics wasn't going to be real popular. So they framed the debate around choice, autonomy, consent, individual liberty. The only problem is they're making the same worldview assumptions that Hazelden did. Some lives are not worth living. That's what's driving this debate, men and women. Make no mistake, it isn't about choice. When you're watching the news, even if you're watching Fox News, you'll hear this. When people start talking about choice and consent and autonomy, that's not what's going on. There's something else that's going on here. Now, by the way, there's another view, there's an anthropology behind this as well, how we view the human person. The anthropology is what we talked about last night, body-self dualism. The real you is not your body, it is what? Your conscious abilities, your desires, your feelings, your thought life. That's the real you. And you could see this come about in the Schiavo case. How many of you remember Terry Schiavo's case? You know that pro-lifers made a colossal error in how they handled that. Do you remember? How did we argue that case? Do you remember what our principal argument was? Well, she could get better. Men and women, she had no duty to get better. You don't intentionally kill people because they don't get better. We didn't challenge that premise. Instead, we had alleged pro-life doctors making medical judgments about her from thousands of miles away who had never even been there. We looked really stupid. What we should have said is, she has value as a human being and it doesn't matter if she gets better. That's the argument that should have been made. We didn't make that argument. We argue, well, she might get better. We know people who have gotten better. She might wake up one day. Why, look at this picture. It looks like she's looking at her parents. Wrong, wrong, wrong. We bought the premise of the other side. That her life depended on her functioning at a certain level. That if she didn't function at a certain level, She really wasn't even there as a person. Wow, did we blow that one. That's the worldview we've got to be careful of. We've got to make sure we're not buying into this notion that some lives are just not worth living. Now, another thing to consider here, as soon as you buy the premise that personhood is based on cognitive ability, you haven't opened the door to involuntary euthanasia. You have literally bought the premise that justifies it. Here's why. If only people who are self-aware count as persons, and you are not self-aware, what are you? A non-person. In our legal system, who has rights, persons or non-persons? Persons. If you are not cognitively present, as some would say, what that means then is people like Terry Schiavo could be forced to undergo involuntary organ donation. Because the rights of real persons override the rights of non-persons, right? That's the medical theory here. Now, what's interesting is that this is not me just making this up. Jeff McMahon, Peter Singer, Helga Cruz, and others have argued that patients in that condition, in persistent vegetative states, unconscious patients who have little hope of recovery, it should be mandatory that they undergo forced organ donation to help others who need those body parts. And as soon as you buy the premise that what gives you your value as a person is your thought ability, not your body life, but rather your conscious person, that whole body-self dualism issue, once you buy that, it's really hard to argue why involuntary euthanasia should not exist. And this is what we see going on in Belgium. This is what we see going on in the Netherlands. It's not just voluntary. It leads right to it because the premise permits it. Everybody clear? I'm not losing you yet early, right? Okay, good. Some of you are like, I hope I don't fade into involuntary comas here when he's in, what he's talking about. Yes. All right. The other dangerous part of this, when we buy this premise, the whole debate over physician-assisted suicide, and I saw this with my sister, we are empowering doctors to make philosophical decisions they're not prepared to make. They're not equipped to do that. Have doctors been trained in moral philosophy? No. They've been trained in medicine. But here's what you're getting. Guys in white coats making value judgments, not medical judgments, value judgments about whose life is worth living. They're not qualified to do that. They're no more qualified than you are. They don't have philosophical training on this. And this is what struck me with my sister. The doctor walks in. He's like, yeah, let's just start making some decisions here. Her life it just would be better off. Wait a minute, dude. I got a graduate degree in philosophy. Where's yours? Okay, he's not qualified to make that decision. Here's what he's qualified to do. He's qualified to tell me that a treatment is worthless. He is not qualified to tell me a patient is. And doctors have become killers because they bought the premise that they can put their philosophy hats on and make philosophical judgments about people's lives rather than just making medical judgments about treatments. In other words, yeah, you should trust the doctor on his opinion about what treatments are worthless. You should never trust a doctor or anyone else for that matter on whose life is worthless. That's the problem in the culture. Second question. Not only should we be concerned about the question of who gets suicide prevention and who gets assistance, and we need to be clear on what this debate is about, we also want to ask, this is the third question if you're taking notes, how does physician-assisted suicide corrupt our concept of human rights? And it does. It does. I think you know that we live in a culture that thinks if I want something, I have a right to it. Desire equals rights in today's culture. I desire something, therefore I have a right to it. The problem is, having a desire to die is not the same as having a right to die. Rights have to be grounded in something. We got to know where they come from. You can't just pluck them out of thin air. And by the way, rights entail responsibility to the surrounding community. If I have a right to die, that means medicine has to help me do it. Pharmacists have to dispense drugs. Doctors have to get involved. Family will be involved. The right to die is not an individual sole decision. It impacts the surrounding community. It's not just me doing my own thing. I mean, if that were the case, then people would simply go kill themselves and not demand that others help them do it. What the right to die movement is really telling us, I have a right to die, and I have a right to force you to help me do it successfully. That is a huge leap. And yet so few people even think about it. That, wait a minute, if I have a right to die, this is going to involve other people. It's not just about me. It's about other people. Now, another thing we did in the Schiavo case that I think was really troubling, we failed to challenge the premise that just because someone wants to die, they ought to die. Remember that? Michael Schiavo was saying, oh, she wants to die. And our response was, no, she doesn't. We bought the premise. You know what we should have said? Maybe you're right. So, go back to your syllogism. It's wrong to intentionally kill innocent human beings. Doctor-assisted suicide does that, or euthanasia does it, and therefore it's wrong. We didn't challenge that. Instead, what we did is we said, well, we don't think she wanted to die. We should have looked him in the eye and said, maybe you're right, maybe you're not, but who cares? How does it follow that because I want to die, that I should die? That nobody challenged that. If your rights are inalienable, you cannot waive them just because you want to die. That's what the Declaration of Independence says. Let's go back to that for a moment. We hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal. Therefore, all men are created equal, having rights to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, right? If your right to life is inalienable, men and women, you cannot waive it. That means it comes from God. You have it whether you want it or not. You can't just arbitrarily decide, I don't want it. And yet what we did is we ended up buying the premise that if she wanted to die, that meant she had a right to die. Question four, can autonomy and consent ground our view of bioethics and death and dying? That just because I have patient autonomy, is that enough to say that's enough, that's all we need to say I have a right to die? And I think we know that it does not. Autonomy does not mean I can sell myself into slavery. A physician cannot mutilate my body even if I want him to. He cannot just arbitrarily say, oh, the patient wants one arm, we'll take one arm off. Your right to an autonomy is reasonably limited. The problem with physician-assisted suicide is this. If the right to die is based on autonomy, you can't limit it, right? Doesn't matter whether I'm 18 or 88. If autonomy is the foundation for a right to die, you cannot tell me that you're going to only let me do it if I'm sick and terminally ill. That means all the safeguards go out the window. And that's why the safeguards never work, the so-called safeguards. In Belgium, you've got involuntary euthanasia happening. You've got it happening in the Netherlands. Why? Because once you buy the premise that autonomy alone gives you a license to make the medical community help kill you, you're not going to be able to limit it to only sick people. The right to autonomy applies to everybody then. And that's why, again, you end up opening the door to massive increase in doctor-assisted suicide and euthanasia because you can't limit autonomy. And it also, by the way, limits the autonomy of doctors. What if you're a doctor and you don't want to involve yourself in this? Guess what happens to you in this system? You get to go abandon your job and go shine shoes. That's what happens. In other words, what about your freedom to say no? Now, I always find this odd. Have you ever noticed it's really odd? The left will tell conservative doctors, you have to refer for abortion. You have to be involved in a woman's right to choose. She has a fundamental right to choose. She has a right to your medical care and will drive you from the field if you don't refer, at least, right? But what if the doctor is being asked to participate in an execution or a lethal injection, a capital punishment case? Do doctors get the right to excuse themselves from that? Yeah, all the time. But yet when it comes to these issues, We're now claiming that patient autonomy means we can override the physician. This is scary stuff, something we need to be very aware of. Okay, question five. Or excuse me, let me say one more thing about autonomy. Are we talking autonomy or patient abandonment? In the state of Oregon, where doctor-assisted suicide is legal, out of 100, I think it was 100, I wrote the number down. Out of 178 physician-assisted suicide cases in the state of Oregon, only 5 of those patients were referred to psychiatric help prior to involving themselves in physician-assisted suicide. Now, here's what's interesting about this. We know from empirical studies that almost all suicidal patients suffer from psychiatric disorders. And yet only 5 were referred to clinical counseling before being offered assisted suicide in Oregon. Is that autonomy or abandoning patients in their need? Arthur Kaplan, who's not a friend of pro-lifers, way to the left of me on bioethics. He said that there was a case a number of years ago involving a guy by the name of Thomas Passmore. Thomas had a hallucination. He thought that his hand had 666 written on it. So he ran his hand through a table saw to cut it off because he didn't want Satan to be part of his body. Now, obviously, what kind of dude are we dealing with right here? One who is mentally struggling, right? So get this. The courts in Pennsylvania would not even order medical staff to sew his hand back on because they didn't want to override patient autonomy. Okay, wait a minute, men and women. Is that respecting autonomy or failing to care for a man in his need? Yeah. I mean, this is a guy who's having hallucinations about 666 on his hand. He runs his hand through a table saw, and we think somehow that's an autonomous choice we should respect? This is crazy stuff, but fits right in with the new dignity we talked about last night, that I have the power to do whatever I want with my life, and no one can tell me differently. That's just scary stuff. And when you wake up Arthur Kaplan to where he calls a red flag on that, you know you're dealing with something that's crazy. Okay, question 5. This is the big one. Is it always wrong to withhold treatment? And the answer is no. No. Many of you said it. We're all going to die sometime. It's going to happen. There is a world of difference between withholding treatment that no longer medically benefits a patient and acting to intentionally kill him. In the case study I gave you, what is killing the patient? Withholding the treatment or his underlying pathology? The underlying pathology. Now, some people say, well, what about food and water? Now, I've asked some physicians about this, and here is what I've been told. That there can be rare cases where at the very end of life, very end, force feeding and force liquidating them is not helping them. They are dying, and you're just making their agony worse. That was certainly the case with my sister, where her liver was gone. And basically, when you hydrated her, her abdomen would fill up. They'd have to go in. She weighs 88 pounds. They have to go in and drain all that out in a surgical maneuver, and she couldn't handle it anymore. We were done. We were at the end with that. But that is very different than saying, as one of you said, I think it was you, that we're going to move the process along. We're aiming at death. If withholding the treatment is aiming at death the way it was in the Shibo case, that is very different than withholding treatment that no longer benefits the patient medically. Everybody clear on that distinction? As Christians and as pro-lifers, we are not obligated to always interfere with natural death. We are obligated to always care and never harm. In other words, we're going to look at that man's life and we're going to say, how can we give him the best care we can, given the life he has, not the one we wished he had? And we're going to care for him in that situation. And it could be in the final stages that withholding the treatment is not a help to him. That is not a failure to act on pro-life principles. That is making the patient as comfortably suited as we can while he goes through this illness. What about the morphine, though? Does anybody, anybody with a little pause on that one? Go ahead.
My grandma was in a congestive heart failure, dying and struggling, and I administered the morphine for 2 days.
Yeah.
Because it did relax her system enough to be able to breathe better.
Yeah.
Versus watching her struggle and die, sucking for air.
Exactly.
So that was a hard decision to make to administer it, but we did in small doses, and I felt at peace.
And when you did that, what were you aiming at?
Comfort.
You weren't aiming at death.
No.
Right.
She had rallied before, so we knew she could fully rally again, you know, but that wasn't the point at that point.
Is it okay for terminally ill patients to sleep before they die?
Yes.
Sure, but we're not going to intentionally kill them. In other words, this is where physicians need to be very careful in their thinking, and this is what troubles me. When you have physicians without a biblical worldview, they're not going to make the fine distinction I'm about to make. That distinction is this. It is one thing for a patient to be given morphine that eases the pain, allows him to sleep. It is quite another to aim at death in doing that. And if your intent is death, you're out of bounds. If your intent is, I'm going to relieve his pain and I don't intend death, but I could foresee it coming sooner rather than later, that's very different than wanting it and aiming at it, which I think you did the right thing in what you did there. We are not administering this for the purpose of creating death. We're administering it to treat the pain.
Over 50 years ago, I was in a position that I had to make a decision about my best friend's life. His parents, his brother, his wife were there, and we were very close. And the wife deferred to me about pulling the plug.
Yeah.
He had a cerebral hemorrhage. There was no brain waves.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing keeping him alive was the machines. And...
There is a difference between pulling the... We need to define what we mean by pulling the plug.
Took him off the machine.
Yes. Now, in that case, what I'm going to gather is he was already dead. What was happening is the machines were preventing his body from decomposing. Unplugging someone in that state is not killing them. They're already gone. But when we do like we did in the Shivo case, where we withdraw food and water with intent to kill her, that's very different. In this case, the patient has already left us. We had this happen locally in our area. A young kid who was 18 who had some kind of terrible illness from the time he was little, he had a personal goal to finish high school. Well, 3 days before he would have graduated, he finally succumbed to his disease. However, the local hospital kept him on life support for 3 days so that his diploma could say that he graduated with his class. And I didn't see anything wrong with this. He was already dead, and at that point they withdrew the life support, so to speak. But the life support wasn't keeping him alive. There had already been an irreversible loss of the body's ability to coordinate itself in a meaningful way that would keep him living. And that's the definition of death. There's a total breakdown of the body's ability to coordinate. Dead corpses have lots of cells on the body, but they're not talking to each other, that, to put it in layman's terms. I'm guessing that's what was going on here. So the decision you made was not one to end his life. You simply let the body begin its decomposing process by unplugging him. Have I got that right?
Exactly.
Okay. I want to end with this, and then we're going to take a break. Physician-assisted suicide robs our pastoral care toward dying patients. Let me talk about advanced directives for a moment. These are not the same as living wills, okay? Advanced directives are where you make known in writing what you want to happen to you if you're ever in a position where you cannot make those needs known at the moment. My friend Melinda Penner at Stand to Reason, I don't know how many of you have heard of Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason, but Melinda Penner worked with Greg Penner, or worked with Greg Kokel at Stand to Reason, and I've known her for 28 years. Last December, Melinda was putting up Christmas lights, one of the smartest women you'll ever meet, putting up Christmas lights, and took a fall off a ladder, fell about 6 feet to the ground, landed head first on the back of her head, and literally just shattered her skull. And she has been in, since then, we're not quite sure what is going on. At first it looked like she would die, then the hemorrhaging, we finally stopped that. And then we're at the point now where we just don't know if she recognizes anybody, we don't know what's up. She's in an assisted care living situation. Melinda, however, 20 years ago, wrote out what she would like to be true of her life. And I think she captures perfectly how to think about this as a Christian. And I'm just going to go ahead and read it to you because it's so profound. And I think part of our pastoral care, for those of you pastors that are here, again, thank you for being here. Part is helping your people think about biblically how they should end well when it comes to the care that will be given them. Listen to Melinda's advanced directives. I'll read them word for word. If I am permanently disabled but not certified terminal, I wish all care provided to sustain my life and alleviate my physical discomfort. I do not wish my life to be terminated due to permanent physical disablement. I personally do not consider nutrition and hydration to be medical treatment, but basic care, which living organisms require to live. I do not wish nutrition and hydration to be withheld or withdrawn to facilitate or accelerate my death, getting to the point you made earlier. Let's see, where am I? I wish my life and death to be a testimony of the intrinsic value of all human beings, which God has given us by virtue of our creation in His image and of my absolute faith and trust in my salvation through my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I have absolute confidence that I will be with God in heaven upon my death and anticipate that time joyfully. Therefore, my life should not be artificially prolonged. However, neither is my life to be artificially shortened based on a functional or instrumental view of human life. She nailed it. Clear. She got the philosophy down. Hey, no one's going to make a value judgment that my life is not worth living. Now, it may be that I'm dying. Yeah, you can let me go. But you're not going to kill me just because you've made a philosophical decision that my life should not be valued. These are things I would encourage all of you to think about doing. I don't care if you're 18 or 80. Think about these advanced directives and get them down on paper so that you can be ready when the time comes, okay? All right, we're going to take a break.
I want to do something first that I think people find interesting, but sure. I'm going to walk back here and talk to a young lady that came from Elk to be with us, runs a crisis pregnancy center, and has doctor-assisted suicide never been before the legislature month numerous times. It will again. Do you know the name of the group that promotes that month across the country? Passion and Choices. They are well-funded leftists. My point is this. If you are associated in any way with the Montana Pastors Network or the Wyoming Pastors Network, would you stand for the Lord, please? Seth, you ought to be standing. Okay. You can be seated. You'd be interested to know that we stole this idea from Wyoming, by the way. Next Thursday, she's going to be with us in Helena. We're forming the Montana Life Coalition. This will be a coalition of people like her, some of the Montana Pastors Network, and my friend Lester and I, Pastor Lester, will be there. And the purpose will be to begin to work together, bring people together from various life associations with the legislators, 10 legislators, and begin to have a conversation about better legislation about life issues in Montana. My point, will you put 12 o'clock Thursday on your prayer calendar? From 12 to 2, we have 2 hours with the legislators. They're going to be in Helena because they're going to be
in Helena next week. And we know we face a public veto on many things we do, but we're going to do it anyway. So thought you'd want to know about that, pray for us. Sure appreciate you guys being here. If you can write us a check